You're listening to Podcast to Practice, brought to you by Springer Healthcare IME. Podcast to Practice brings you expert-led independent medical education discussions, inspiring healthcare professionals to maximize their learning and make measurable changes in their own clinical practice.
This podcast is part of an independent medical education program entitled the AML Expert Series, Innovations in Molecular Testing, Emerging Therapies and Targeted Treatments. It is intended for healthcare professionals only and is supported by an independent educational grant from Rigel.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today. We are going to have a fantastic educational program with the title Deep Dive into Targeted Therapies, Understanding IDH1 Mutant AML Treatments, where we will be discussing the mechanism of action, the safety, the selection of therapies, the efficacy, and the combination and sequencing of IDH1 inhibitors. So my name is Amer Zeidan. I'm a professor of medicine at Yale University, and it's a true pleasure to be joined today by a top expert in the field, Dr. DiNardo, who has been very instrumental in approval of some of those therapies that we will be discussing today. Courtney, thank you so much for joining us. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Yes. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Courtney DiNardo. I am here at MD Anderson in Houston, Texas. And just very much looking forward to discussion with you today on IDH inhibitors.
Perfect. Thank you. So as I think many of our audience knows, that the management of acute myeloid leukemia has seen significant changes over the last decade. We understood that those patients should not be treated the same way, not in one uniform treatment, the same way we used to do it 10 years ago when we gave either intensive chemotherapy or hypomethylating agents. And we clearly understood that the importance of precision medicine or individualized treatment, because there are different drivers for different subsets of AML, and probably the best management is going to be directed towards those specific providers, including, for example, FLT3 mutations, IDH1 and 2 mutations, and other subsets that I think are being understood more, such as TP53 and KRAS, NRAS, etc. So this episode is going to focus more on IDH inhibitors, particularly IDH1 inhibitors. And maybe we can start, Courtney, by explaining to the audience what is an IDH1 mutation and how does it contribute to the leukemogenesis in some patients with acute myeloid leukemia?
Sure. So IDH1 mutations are not kind of the most common mutation, but they're actually quite prevalent in acute myeloid leukemia. About 8 up to 10% of patients can have an IDH1 mutation. And the IDH1 mutations are interesting in that it creates this this specific mutation that creates what's called an oncometabolite, where you have this kind of essentially poisoning of the cells, where it creates, like, scientifically what's called a hypermethylated phenotype. But what it's doing is it's preventing kind of that normal myeloid maturation, and so these cells get stuck in the leukemia blast phase and helps to promote malignancy and leukemia in that way.
And I think the recognition of this pathway has been a very important step in the development of therapies, which I think it's always very satisfying to us as, you know, clinical researchers to see discoveries in the lab get translated into therapies that help our patients. So maybe you can overview for us the currently approved therapies for IDH1, as well as some of the major clinical trials that looked at these drugs.
Yeah. So so because you have this kind of altered mutation creating this oncometabolite, the question is, you know, can you turn that off? So there has been the development of actual mutant-targeted IDH inhibitors, both IDH1 and IDH2 we won't talk about as much today, but kind of you get these two different mutations leading to this kind of abnormal physiology that have we figured out how to create molecules that can turn it off. So for the IDH1 story, the first IDH1 inhibitor was a compound called ivosidenib. And there is now a second IDH1 inhibitor that's now also approved called olutasidenib. So just as background, we now have two IDH1 inhibitors. And they both function as small molecules. They're oral therapies that that kind of turn off that abnormal mutant process that's happening and allow cells to kind of normally differentiate to turn into the normal myeloid counterparts that they're supposed to. So just briefly, you know, when you asked about a summary of the trials, the first one, ivosidenib, was approved in the relapse setting for patients with IDH1 mutation. So you have to have this mutation for the IDH inhibitors to work. And in the ivosidenib study, we saw about a kind of a 30% response rate and about a 40% what we call overall response rate. So I should clarify. So like a complete remission or a complete remission with incomplete count recovery, it's about 30%. And then when you kind of open it up to include any sort of response, about 40%. And that was significant, right? So you have about a third or more of patients, you know, becoming transfusion independent that were previously needing transfusions, you know, improving counts, oral outpatient therapy, leading to improved quality of life. And so the ivosidenib was approved, and then olutasidenib was approved more recently with very similar kind of data in the relapse setting. So again, a composite remission rate of about 30%, a response rate of about 40%. So when you look at the numbers, they're quite similar. So we have two different kind of excellent drugs that are approved. One thing that's a little bit notable about olutasidenib is that the duration of the remission seemed to last a little bit longer. And so whether these weren't, of course, randomized trials compared against each other, so whether they were different populations or whether there is something kind of unique that olutasidenib is leading to longer remissions is something that you know was notable in those two kind of approval studies. And then the third study I want to mention, the last one I want to mention, is the AGILE study. So that's where we've taken the IDH inhibitors, which work well as a single agent in the relapse setting, and kind of the concept, of course, is to try to move it to the front line where we're giving it in combinations for effective frontline therapy. And so the AGILE study looked at kind of a standard treatment azacitidine with the IDH1 inhibitor ivosidenib. And in the setting for older patients not fit for intensive chemotherapy getting aza-ivo, we saw composite remissions of over 50% with an overall survival in a randomized fashion, like an overall survival of over 2 years, so 29 months, which is pretty remarkable for that older, unfit AML population. So those are kind of the three, I think, most impactful trials leading to kind of approved settings to be using the IDH1 inhibitors.
Yeah, and I think this kind of exemplifies the typical paradigm of development in oncology, where we start with single agent in the refractory lab setting, and once we have an effective and safe drug, we go to the front line and in combinations. And as you mentioned, there are also ongoing trials, of course, with triplets and with intensive chemotherapy. And it's very satisfying to kind of see, I think, the increased number of trials that are looking at these agents. Like you, I struggle to kind of completely differentiate between the two drugs. We had, I think, a very interesting discussion with Dr. Wang as well about some of that and how do we choose between these two agents. And I always, you know, people think a lot about CML as a paradigm for the development of multiple good agents to treat the same disease, and how do you sequence between them and how do you follow them. And just for the audience, are there, like, do you check for specific mutations based on which you would use these drugs, or how do you think about sequencing them in your practice?
So there's no specific kind of mutation or co-mutation that I'm aware of that would make me want to use ivosidenib over olutasidenib or vice versa. For me, it's more of a side effect profile would be the easiest way to discriminate. So for instance, ivosidenib does have a QTC signal. And so you have to be monitoring EKGs. So if I had a patient that, you know, is on multiple different QT prolonging agents and has, or maybe a family history or a personal history of, you know, a cardiomyopathy or a QTC abnormality, that would be something to maybe make me opt more for olutasidenib. Whereas olutasidenib has a AE side effect profile of transaminitis. And so which ivosidenib doesn't. So if I have a patient who you know, maybe at baseline has a mild transaminitis or is on other things leading to a transaminitis, that might be kind of one reason I would choose one over the other. The only other thing I would say in terms of selecting one versus the other is there's good data on olutasidenib in the post-venetoclax setting, and ivosidenib just doesn't have that peer-reviewed data that I'm aware of. And so when you're in the olutasidenib study of the single agent in the relapse setting, there was still a for me, rather surprising, like 50% response rate, like 30% true CR, CRH, and about a 50% response rate in patients that had already failed venetoclax, which tends to be a really challenging population where there you know aren't as many good responses in the post-ven setting. So if I do have a patient that's had a frontline regimen with maybe aza-ven and I'm wanting to use an IDH1 inhibitor as a second line, I might opt for olutasidenib given that data.
Yeah, I think all of these are excellent observations. And, you know, like I think many in the field, I struggle to how biologically kind of explain these kind of trends that have been kind of seen in some of those trials. And of course, we don't have head-to-head comparisons. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, two good drugs, but like any good effective drug, they do come with some side effects, which you kind of touch on a little bit. But how do you in your practice monitor and manage these side effects?
Yeah, I mean, the side effects are not, I mean, these are pretty well-tolerated oral therapies. So I think the most important thing is to realize that these are things that can have side effects. So you do want to monitor your patient the first month or two when a patient is on a new therapy. Even though it's oral, I don't say, you know, come back and see me in 3 months. You do want to be following labs and being on top of things. For olutasidenib, the transaminitis is something I'm watching for. So I'm, you know, making sure to be monitoring LFTs in addition to, you know, the CBC and the general chemistries. With ivosidenib, it's the QT monitoring. So making sure I'm doing monthly EKGs at the beginning so that if there is a QT signal, I can maybe drop something else they're on that could also be affecting the QT. The main side effect with both of the IDH inhibitors, which is true for the IDH2 inhibitor enasidenib also, is differentiation syndrome. So about 12 to 15% of patients that are getting an IDH inhibitor as a single agent will have differentiation syndrome, which is really nonspecific. So you're not going to know you have a patient with DS unless you're thinking about it, because it's nonspecific, like fevers and shortness of breath and effusions and things that are so easy for us to call infection or call relapsed leukemia. And so being aware of that constellation and starting steroids is really important. That tends to happen usually in the end of the first cycle, early into the second cycle when you're using an IDH inhibitor. So those are the main side effects I think about.
Yeah, and I share your experience that these drugs are generally among the easiest of drugs to kind of deal with. They are very well tolerated, but of course, very important to pay attention to development of differentiation syndrome, which you know can sometimes sneak on you and can significantly cause problems if you don't pay close attention to it. So, Courtney, you discussed very nicely the trials that led to the current approval of these agents as a monotherapy in the relapsed refractory setting, and in combination with azacitidine and also as a single agent for older unfit patients with acute myeloid leukemia who have the IDH1 mutation for ivosidenib. Can you tell us more about the ongoing trials that are looking at these agents in combinations? And you've been a pioneer of several of those trials.
Sure. So I think, you know, one of the main questions, which we didn't talk about, is, you know, is how do I know whether to prioritize an IDH inhibitor or venetoclax, right? When I have a newly diagnosed IDH1 patient, should I use, you know, a hypomethylating agent and an IDH1 inhibitor, or should I use a hypomethylating agent and venetoclax? And so I think what I'm struck by in the AGILE study is really the impressive overall survival and the well-tolerated nature of azacitidine and ivosidenib. So I like that idea, but we're only getting like 55% of people responding to aza-ivo, right? It's not 100%. We need to do better. And so that's where kind of these triplet trials, many of them are kind of ongoing at our institution that we've started. And I think I think I don't want to get out there and say everyone should be putting their patient with an IDH1 mutation on a triplet. I don't think we're there yet, but I've been really encouraged by the fact that we're seeing response rates now up towards like 90% when you're putting a hypomethylating agent, an IDH1 inhibitor, and venetoclax together. And we're shortening the venetoclax durations when we do it this way. They're only getting 14 days of venetoclax, so maybe preventing some of the more prolonged myelosuppression that you could see if you were giving it continuously. And what's going to really matter is, are we seeing more patients become MRD negative, get deeper remissions, have those remissions last longer? And, you know, the studies are still relatively early, but we're seeing really strong signals that, you know, MRD negative rates are upwards of 85%. Survival looks really good. We're not seeing early mortality from this combination. So I think that's something that is actually moving forward in Europe, an AMLSG HOVON study that's going to be looking at kind of AZA-IVO versus AZA-IVO-VEN as a triplet to see if this really is kind of a new, well-tolerated and more effective strategy.
Yeah, and this is all very exciting, clearly, for our patients. Maybe we can touch a little bit on the intensive chemo combinations. And again, some of those trials were done initially in the U.S., as a single arm, but I think similar to what you just mentioned, the randomized trials are happening now in Europe.
Yeah, so that's another, I mean, when we talk about IDH1 mutations, we're usually talking about older, more frail patients, because on average, they tend to be older. But there is, you know, certainly a percentage of younger patients who have IDH mutations. There was a non-randomized phase 2 study looking at just standard 7 and 3 intensive chemo with ivosidenib. And responses look good. It was an older, you know, like we were just saying, the average patient in that study was over 60, which is pretty, you know, is on the older age for these, you know, intensive chemotherapy studies. About a third were secondary, had already had MDS before. So a pretty high risk population. And in that, you know, given that population, the fact that 3/4 of patients responded and survival looked good, I think is encouraging and suggests that adding an IDH1 inhibitor to intensive chemotherapy, it kind of makes sense that should be an effective strategy, similar to the way we add FLT3 inhibitors to FLT3 mutated patients. And so there's a very large, HOVON AMLSG study in Europe that has finished enrolling. So all the patients have enrolled and they're just following them now for those survival endpoints in a placebo-controlled randomized study. So hopefully, I've heard maybe towards the end of this year or next year, we'll have some results to see if adding an IDH inhibitor to intensive chemo improves outcomes too.
Yeah, and I think that would be clearly amazing news to our patients. I think really, really great drugs. The main problem is the relative rarity of these mutations, around 5 to 7% with IDH1. However, when you add them up together with the IDH2 mutation and FLT3 mutations and other, evolving targetable mutations such as NPM1 for MIN inhibitors, etc., I think most of the patients with AML, like you said, should really be considered for clinical trials these days as we continue, hopefully, to try to improve the outcomes further for our patients. So we are coming to the end of this podcast, but maybe you can give our audience your kind of key take-home messages about the evolving landscape of IDH1 mutant acute myeloid leukemia.
So I think my gestalt is that the IDH inhibitors are very effective for IDH1 mutated disease. So I think people kind of hear a lot about how effective venetoclax is for IDH mutated leukemias. And I think that's true, especially for IDH2. You know, IDH2 mutated patients respond incredibly well to venetoclax-based therapy. IDH1 do okay with VEN, but I think they do even better with IDH inhibitors. So I think that is maybe the story I would say, is that it's a rare mutation, but if you see it, it's important because it might make you want to think, I should be prioritizing a regimen that includes an IDH inhibitor. They're well tolerated and they're effective. And hopefully in the future, we'll be combining them together to make really effective curative strategies.
Yeah, and I think it's important to remember, as you mentioned, that these mutations should be checked for not only at diagnosis, but also at subsequent time points, because even if you did not use an IDH1 inhibitor because People wanted to move quickly with treatment and the patient got azaven or got intensive chemo and subsequently relapse, I think IDH1 inhibitor certainly is a reasonable option at relapse, and these are approved drugs. I think, in addition to the trials you mentioned, the role of maintenance, I think, is something that is being kind of explored post-transplant, because still many of those patients would relapse post-transplant, and I think there is increasing interest in post-transplant strategies. So with that, I'd like to thank you very much for your excellent discussion and thoughts, and I would like to thank our audience for listening, and I would encourage all of our audience to watch the entire video podcast series. Thank you so much, and have a good day.
Thank you for listening to Podcast to Practice, brought to you by Springer Healthcare IME. For more information on our educational programs available, visit ime.springerhealthcare.com.